Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and we are going to be discussing a subject that always fascinates people around the world. It's going to be a discussion about Egypt and Egypt's history. And my guests today, Thomas Brophy and Robert Boval, they're people that love history, and they have compiled some fascinating information that I know you will want to hear more about. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Hello, Donna. Great to be here with you.
Now, I was intrigued about the alliance between you and Robert Boval because he is an Egyptologist in his own way. He's written a number of books, and he's been in documentaries on the subject of Egypt. He has talked about some very controversial information, and you are an astrophysicist. You've worked with NASA. You were a member of the Voyager 2 spacecraft instrument team. You have done books yourself, and you've written articles in scientific journals. How did the two of you ever come together to do this research for this book called Black Genesis, the Prehistoric Origins of Ancient Egypt? How did the two of you connect?
Okay, I guess it does sound a little bit like a sort of an odd couple, but there's actually a sort of natural connection for this project especially. I could tell a sort of a short story about how this teaming up came about, if you like.
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
Okay, so I would start with my research is on the astronomy of the site called Nabta Playa in the desert in southern Egypt. And I wrote up some of that research in a book called The Origin Map. And then after a while, I started receiving some of the most enthusiastic responses to that from black African American scholars. And I hadn't really anticipated that because when I first started researching the astronomy of Nabta Playa, I was approaching it simply as a sort of astronomical puzzle. And then this interest for the cultural implications of that work started coming in. And that is what essentially led to me and Robert Boval teaming up. Let's see, when I was doing my puzzle-solving work, I was just approaching it from the astronomical level, the astronomical part of the archaeo-astronomical field, and puzzle-solving. I wasn't researching the cultural implications at that point. And then when some results started coming out, and the cultural implications started becoming more clear, Robert Boval and I started talking because we had some contact before because I had done some sort of testing, mathematical testing of his famous Orion correlation theory for the Great Pyramid at Giza. And, to make it a little shorter story, we were aware of other sites, even deeper in the desert, the region that's called the Western Desert of Egypt, which is the northeastern Sahara Desert, very remote areas, and intriguing sites out there that had been very little visited, and it became clear to us that those sites were probably related to the very ancient people who had created the Nabta Playa site, and that they were also the culture that had led to the origin of the pharaonic civilization in the Nile Valley.
Your book starts out, let me just back up for a minute, your book starts out with some fascinating information about a black African professor who in 1954 published a thesis which was really advocating black African origin for the Egyptian civilization. I have to tell you, when I saw that, I said, oh, of course, that makes sense. That was something, I don't know why, I was made aware of a long time ago. But let's face it, this is a very close link to Africa. So it wasn't really a surprise, but it really was a surprise to a lot of people. In fact, the gentleman was just absolutely just put down so badly. Now, this was in 1954. Why was it that his thesis was just absolutely under no consideration of any kind at all?
Yeah, that was, I think you're talking about Sheikh Anta Diop, the
yes.
Senegalese scholar. He, by the way, is very highly revered in Senegal and amongst North African scholars today, still. And it was, 1954, he had been researching this question very rigorously, and I think in the book we mentioned that he had started doing that research in Paris when he was a graduate student in physics. And by 1954, he had a good body of research and evidence, and he presented it to an international conference of Egyptologists, I believe it was in Cairo, and he presented very good evidence to the effect that the originators of the Nile Valley civilization we call ancient Egypt or Kemet were African, and of course Egypt is in Africa, so it shouldn't be all that surprising, but. Yes, he was very poorly received at that conference, even though his work was apparently very good. And so we think, you know, that just points out that there, at that time, there was a bias towards the concepts of the ancient Egyptians as to their race. And we include his work and as one piece of the puzzle, and it would be good if Anta Diop would get in the long run more recognition that he deserves and should have received back then.
You talk in your book, you have a chapter called Strange Stones, and you mention in the book how in the 1960s that in Egypt the population was about 10 million at the turn of the 19th century, and it exploded, literally exploded, by 1960. Let me correct myself, it was before 1960, but by 1960 it had gone to 50 million people, and so they really were in quite a dilemma because they didn't have a way of producing energy, and that's when Nasser decided he was going to build the dam. And of course there were archaeological areas that would have been just fabulous that went underwater, that with the building of the dam they tried to rescue as much of it as possible, but it was almost an insurmountable task because of the massiveness of the buildings they tried to move and everything else. You bring out also information about how the Egyptian Sahara remains mostly unexplored and that there is this tremendous, tremendous amount of information that's under the sands of thousands and thousands of years. And
oh, yes.
You go through this and you go, wow. this could be an archaeologist's dream. I mean, look at how many things they have just discovered in the last 10, 15 years.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And that is a nice connection to modern history that everybody knows about, you know, the building of the Aswan High Dam and the flooding of that part of the Nile Valley. And, of course, it was the effort led by UNESCO, the United Nations Organization, to move the temples and statues that are at Abu Simbel. And that was just part. That was sort of the big major engineering feat to move those. But that was part of a whole effort to reclaim, it's supposed to be part of a whole effort to reclaim and investigate the ancient archaeology of the whole region.
Mm-hmm.
And so this site, Nabta Playa, that is one of the centerpieces of our study, was discovered by the team led by Frank Wendorf. That was funded by that same UNESCO organization effort that moved the temples for the Aswan High Dam. And that whole region going west, inland, into the desert, from the Nile, all the way to these mountain ranges called Gilf Kebir and Jebel Uwainat, is, like you say, it's very little explored, and important finds are coming out even very recently. One obvious one was in 2007, an inscription, a pharaonic cartouche, an inscription was found in the Uwainat region, which is in the far southwest corner of Egypt, 600 kilometers from the Nile Valley, hundreds of kilometers further away from the Nile than anybody found any pharaonic inscriptions before. So that just turned on its head the notion of how far the early pharaohs had traveled. It was a sixth dynasty inscription. And mm-hmm. that was one of the goals of our expedition that Robert and I went on in 2008 to that region to see that just discovered cartouche and a newly discovered beautiful rock art cave. You know, it's like almost like the Lascaux of the North Sahara that was discovered also in 2007. So. Yes, this region is fascinating, and it's a bit of a mystery as to why the archaeologists haven't gotten out there more. Certainly, they have plenty to do closer to the Nile as well, but it's something that is there to be investigated. Now, it may be part of that. It was just too much outside the notion of.
Mm-hmm.
What the picture of their picture of the early Old Kingdom was. So,
well, at that time, the early Old Kingdom was lush and tropical and absolutely awesome, and it wasn't dry and desert like it is today. So, to take a mindset and sift away from the sand, so to speak, recognizing that this was an area that was lush and rich, both in animal life and in plant life. And whatever caused the weather changes, who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that happens. But what I found was most interesting is that there were radiocarbon processes done because you found cow burials at Nabta Playa, and they were found to be 5,500 BCE, which means it was 2,000 years. These cows had been there for a long time. 2,000 years before the emergence of the well-known cattle cults of ancient Egypt. And I'm going, okay, this is really going to cause some history books to be thrown out the window. This is something that really is quite interesting. What's the position with Egyptologists regarding these discoveries? Are they getting excited about it, or are they pulling their hair out and saying, no, this isn't right, you don't know what you're doing? What's the response? Because you've got so much fascinating information in here that doesn't fit with the thesis, if you will, of what has been proposed for so many generations.
Yeah, I guess much of the response is more in the latter part of what you suggested than the former, but some of the response is both, and it is an interdisciplinary thing. You know, like you were mentioning the climate studies and all this, and for a long time, Egyptology got kind of narrow in its discipline, and the relevance and importance of these interdisciplinary things, like the fact that the climate was lush and not desert until just about 3400 BC, when which is also when the Naftoplia site was abandoned and it became hyper-arid like it is today, and we think, and like we discuss in the book, that was the culture that went to the Nile and created the Nile Valley, because, like you mentioned, the cattle burials that were circa 5500 BC, and also the astronomy at Naftoplia site, which was Wendorf and his team, they called it the regional ceremonial center. And it's clear it was probably, we could call it a regional astro-ceremonial center because of the astronomy at the site, the megalithic astronomy. And back to the interdisciplinary aspect relevance to Egyptology, even the Wendorf's team that discovered and first excavated the Naftoplia site, he was an anthropologist, and they were not what you would call traditional Egyptologists. They were prehistoric anthropologists, and so even they're considered kind of outsiders. So it's changing, but it takes bringing in this integrative, multidisciplinary stuff to change things, it seems.
Well, I would agree with that, and that's nothing new. I mean, look at how long people have tried in the past when we read history. They'll say, no, this is the best way to do something, until somebody comes along with something better, and they'll say, this is what you need to do. They go, oh, no, we've been doing this for 1,000 years. Well, excuse me, this is perhaps better. There's a fascinating information regarding geometry and mathematics and the circles of stones that are like Stonehenge in England, and that gives rise to a lot of thoughts. And I know in my mind, well, if there was a similar patterning which was tracking the stars, whatever was going on, it's so fascinating to find these things coming up to the surface, so to speak, just absolutely showing anyone that has an open mind there's so much we don't know about the peoples that were around previously. Now, talk for a little bit about the Lost Oasis, because Hassanin was a real explorer, and he took a special desert journey, and he really had quite an adventure.
Sure. Yeah, Hassanin, he was quite a character, apparently, and he was the explorer who first went to that region of the deep desert. He went down from the Siwa oasis area, near the Mediterranean coast, south to this area that is now the west corner of Egypt. It borders Sudan and Libya, and that's where this mountain range called Jebel Uwainat is. And Hassanin discovered it. It's this giant mountain. They call it like the Alps of the desert. And it wasn't even known to Europeans until I think it was 1922 that Hassanin traveled down there. And there is an oasis there. And this whole region today is hyper-arid, extreme dry, and that's one of the only wells, oases in a large area, and that is where this cartouche was discovered from the sixth dynasty in 2007, and it's also very recently been discovered that there was a trail, the Abu Balas Trail, that goes from the oases region, the Karga oasis, which is closer to the Nile, and their well-known Old Kingdom remains in that region. This Abu Balas Trail goes from there down to the southwest to this lost oasis in Uwainat mountain area. And for a long time, there are these rumors of a whole lost city, Zarzura. And that was one of the things Hassanein was looking for, and the other early explorers, like Ralph Bagnold, who was a bit later in 1930. And this Abu Balas Trail seems to have gone down to the Uwainat region, where this cartouche was discovered, and continued into the central Sahara. And we think that's was traveled in Old Kingdom times. In fact, there were written about expeditions sent, Harkuf, in the 6th Dynasty, I think it was, and expeditions sent by the pharaohs, and it wasn't really known until recently that this is where they were sent to. They were just... Egyptologists knew that the pharaohs had sent expeditions out in the desert for trade, and there was also speculation about where they went. It's pretty clear now that this is where they went. They went down that Abu Balas Trail into this Uwainat region and continued in the central Sahara. And we think they were reconnecting with their ancient ancestors who came from that region. For all the other evidence we discuss in the book as to why this is where their precursor culture came from, and they seem to have still been trading with them, connecting with them in Old Kingdom times.
You bring out a point of information where the Dije Defri, and I may not be pronouncing it exactly correct, the Water Mountain has images of giraffes, elephants, and all kinds of creatures that, since at least 4,000 BCE, could only be found thousands of kilometers further south in Africa. But here are all of these points of information. There they are. These people, this was really a very lush area. So the animals were abundant there.
Yes, and this rock art showing the animals and the people is very abundant out in the Uwainat region, and it is there in the Jedefri Water Mountain. That's what this temple in the desert is called. And the Jedefri site, Jedefri was a fourth dynasty pharaoh. You know, he's considered to be traditionally the son of Khufu. It's got the cartouche of Jedefri in this desert site, and that is like the first way station on this Abu Balas Trail. And it has, together with the pharaonic cartouche and the hieroglyphs, it's got these prehistoric imagery, prehistoric rock art, like you said, giraffes and other things. And so that's more connection of the Old Kingdom culture with the prehistoric culture from the same region. And in fact, using the same site, like at the Jedefri, it's called the Jedefri Water Mountain. And we actually discovered that it seems to have also an astronomical aspect of the, has a mound that traces the solstice sunrises and equinox sunrises. We go into that in the book a bit. Yes. Okay, what was the original question on that?
No, it was merely, it was more like a comment. You mention a fellow Carlo Bergman as an explorer. It seemed like he had a very strong intuitive sense regarding where artifacts might be, and he just knew the desert. He just had the feel for it. But one of the things I wanted to bring out, and this is very important, in the Egyptian Sahara, especially around the places that we've been discussing, there seems to be no life at all. There's no plants, no animals, not even insects, only sand and rocks, dust, drifting sand dunes, fossils, loose pebbles, and compacted desert pavement. I'm quoting from your book, Loose Boulders and Bedrock Outcrops. Now, you say that the deep Egyptian Sahara is the location on Earth most like what we would anticipate a Martian landscape would be. Yet NASA, in 1981, used a radar imaging camera, and when it used that camera on the Egyptian Sahara, they found contours of dried-out ancient rivers and lakes. And this was a whole big deal because that meant there was a dramatic climatic change that occurred that caused what was lush and beautiful to become a desert wasteland. When did that happen?
Yeah, I think that was the space shuttle camera that was used. And that was that NASA imagery that could see under the sand and see the outlines of the lakes and the rivers. That was sort of the big event that caused paleoclimatologists to really say, yes, definitely, you can see that this region was not desert at that time, which was only up to as recent as about 4,000 BC.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when specifically the region around the Naphtha Playa area went to hyper-desert around 3400 BC, which is just right when you start to see the popping up of the early Nile Valley civilization temples. And that's one more firm bit of evidence that this is, you know, why the people moved from that region to the Nile Valley at that time. And the paleoclimatology now is really very well accepted that that's when the region went dry.
Now, these people were very knowledgeable about the stars, and I know that we don't have a whole bunch of extra time here, but there's so much with astronomy that you go into. The circles of stones that you found, which again you said were very much like Stonehenge, and you have these marvelous, marvelous photographs that are in the book for people that really want to get into the technical information that is available. But there's so much about Egypt that is coming forth because of modern technology and the curiosity of individuals. This is something that eventually, I think it's going to be accepted. I especially was interested in the fact that Diop, he said it was possible to know the skin color of an ancient corpse by the microscopic analysis of the melanin content in the body. This man was so far ahead of everyone else, and I'm sure he'll be given credit, but it's been really a tough journey to be able to have authorization to go and get a little tiny microscopic piece of something off of a mummy. There are lots of people that don't want that. Am I correct?
Yes. Yes, I think you're correct. It's hard to pin down a reason, a specific reason for the sort of stonewalling or barriers to that. You know, the standard claim, I've been inside sort of standard academia for a while myself, so the standard claim is, well, we only allow people access who have all the traditional credentials and you know, and are in the right research groups and all this. But so we have to be a little careful when we ascribe motives, but a lot of people tend to think that there were other motives to keeping specifically Diop away, because he had the tools to get the answer, and he was going to get an answer that a lot of people at that time didn't like. I think that is changing. Very recent Egyptologists seem to be much more open to the broader influence of the true influence of the African people who created the African civilization of Egypt.
Well, it is fascinating as we read. For those of you listening, Black Genesis, The Prehistoric Origins of Ancient Egypt, Robert Bovall and Thomas Brophy, both of these men have a passion for facts, information, and solving puzzles. And the history of Egypt is one of those passions. Thomas, quickly, can you give me your website that people can go to find out more about the work that you've done and the books you've written?
ThomasGBrophy.com, or actually more up to date is my Facebook page. Just go to my Facebook page and friend me there.
All right. Thomas G. Brophy, B like boy, R-O-P-H-Y. It's been a delight having you as a guest. Black Genesis, what a read. It will change your mind about a lot of things. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. Thank you, Thomas, again for being my guest. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. 1-800-959-1007, Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Welcome back. I want you to know telephone lines are open, and if you wanted to give me a buzz, call me at 888-627-6008. Well, today is Veterans Day, and so many of you have the day off, and you're enjoying yourselves, and I just think it's wonderful that you have the opportunity to do that. And I had a request from one of our listeners to share a story about, or to talk about, veterans. Well, a few years back, I interviewed Michael Takeff, and he did a phenomenal book that he titled Brave Men, Gentle Heroes. And it was all about fathers and sons that had been in the Second World War and Vietnam. Of course, Veterans Day came about because of World War I. And I think it's a good thing to do. Freedom is something that we have to be willing to stand up and fight for. And the young men and women that are dedicated to it, as well as people of all ages around the world who fought so hard in World War II, to keep a horrific cancer of oppression from taking over the world. These stories are very, very powerful, but this particular story is about Perry Pollins. And in 1940, he was 16 years of age, and he went to Montreal to join the Canadian Navy. 16 years old. We have a member of our family who has since passed away, but he was 15, 16 years old when he signed up to go into the military service. And lots of people today would say, oh, that's horrible. Well, they didn't have records then, and a lot of young men, they needed young men to go to war. And they were tall, they were strong, they were healthy, they took them. That's just the way it was, World War II. Well, Perry was, as I said, 16. He made two runs to England aboard a Lend-Lease transport ship, and on the way home from the second, a German submarine torpedoed the vessel. Now, the ship survived, but Perry ended up taking shrapnel in his knee. And he was recuperating in a hospital in St. John's, Newfoundland, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Well, when that happened, you can imagine, as a young American, he immediately wanted to enlist in the American military. So he left the hospital, and the day after he left, he enlisted. And he said that he was asked, because he was Jewish, by a doctor who was checking him out for his physical capacities to be able to serve. He said, why does a nice Jewish boy like you want to join the Marine Corps? And at 16, his words were, I want to kill Japs. Well, you got shrapnel in your leg, and I can make you a 4F. He said, I want to fight. The doctor signed a form for him to be able to enlist. So he said he went into the Marines, and he was telling Michael, as he was sharing his story with him, he said, we had to learn how to use a bayonet. They were going to really work them out, and they worked them very, very hard. The Marines are known for their intensity and their toughness. He said, the discipline was demanding. It was intrusive. In the Marine Corps, when you took an order from a superior officer, non-com or commissioned, you did it. Without question, you did it. They knocked you around. They kicked you in the ass. They came up behind you with their swagger stick and hit you behind the knees. Looking back, it was harsh, but boy, it sure was pervasive, persuasive. And he said, in the Marine Corps, you did things over and over and over again. If you didn't do it, they yelled at you. They denigrated you. They beat you. He said, I think rote is the best teacher of anything. They worked us because they said, if you're not worked, you're not going to be able to survive in a battle. So they had them do it over and over and over and over and over again. Perry said, and he was a mature man when this interview took place, he said it was hard. As a teenager, I didn't want to go through it. But he said it enabled me to survive a war. And I think so many times when we have not experienced a war, when individuals have never seen what it really takes to do the job that has to be done, it's so easy to complain and say, oh, they shouldn't go through these disciplines. This is too tough. This is too harsh. If ever you've seen any aspect of war, you will realize that you do have to be prepared. If you're not prepared, you cannot survive. And sadly, there are always those people that are going to want to take away the rights of freedom, of freedom-loving people. You look through history, it's replete with examples. So it's always important to realize it takes discipline, it takes training, it takes commitment, and it takes the heart to say, I am here to take care of what needs to be done. And I think you'll find the young people of today volunteer to go into the services, because today it is volunteer. There's not the draft. The draft was in place in the 40s. They could call anybody up for duty. In our country, at this time, it is all volunteer. So I think these people, young people, men and women both, deserve the respect that they honestly do earn. And again, it's all giving us the opportunity to do what we do today. This radio show in many parts of the world would never be permitted. But it is here. And we have the freedom of choice. And I, as a woman, can choose to have whoever I want on my show. A lot of places you can't do that. So you see, I think it's a pretty important thing to remember. And honoring the veterans of the past as well as those of the present, recognizing there's no such thing as a free lunch. We all have to do what is necessary to keep these freedoms strong and healthy. And that's why education is so important, and it's so vitally important that we keep an open mind and be willing to continuously learn. That is so important. When you get apathetic about life, that's when somebody will come in and say, hey, I think I know what's better for you than you do. Mm-mm. No, that's why people from around the world want to come to the United States, because they have the opportunity to be who they want to be if they're willing to work for it. Donna Zeebo here. Telephone lines are open, 888-627-6008. I'm so excited. Tomorrow, Quantum Mind the Workshop. Oh, we were over setting up today. Beautiful environment. For those of you who are listening in Western Washington, give me a call if you want to come out to the class tomorrow, which is going to be from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. The doors are going to be open at 9:15 for registration. Saturday, November the 12th, yes. And it's $39.95 prepaid or $45 at the door. And I'm so excited. Robert Newman is a feng shui specialist. We are going to be talking about how you can bring a harmony into your life just by what you do with your space, your living space. And then I'm going to be working with those that come, showing how your intuitive skills can work in ways you would never imagine. So it's going to be very interactive. We want this workshop to empower you. We're going to have refreshments, and the atmosphere is just absolutely wonderful. It's in a beautiful facility called Bridgeport Place. So if you want to come, give me a call, 253-582-5604. Call me, 253-582-5604. It is absolutely awesome. I just am totally thrilled with it, and just so many special things are going to be shared tomorrow, and I would love to be able to have you there to do it. So again, 253-582-5604. That's my office number, but this is the number for you to call into if you would like to chat with me directly, and that's 888-627-6008. And if you just give me your first name or initial, of course, I always like to know what part of the country you're calling in from, and then just sit back, relax, let me tell you what I perceive, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything you like. 888-627-6008. There are so many ways that people contribute in life, and I think that we are living in challenging times. It's true, but when haven't there been challenging times? They've always been around. I was listening to a young lady today, because here in the state of Washington, a law was passed where there's no longer going to be the state liquor stores. That's the only place you could ever buy what you call the hard liquor. And the state liquor stores have been in that positioning for a long time. Well, the voters here in the state of Washington said, no, privatize it. And what is going to happen is that there's going to be about 900 employees of the liquor store system by the state that are going to be out of a job by June of 2012. So the host on this one show was wanting feedback from his audience, and I only had the opportunity to hear a couple of people, but this young woman called in that I just thought was really, really sharp. And she said, I'm a graphic artist, and she said, I can empathize with these people, because here in the state of Washington, the economy has been really, really hard and harsh, and a lot of businesses that I've worked for have gone under. They've had to close their doors. She said, I have been laid off 7 times in the past 8 years, I guess it's been. Now, think about that, laid off 7 times. So she said, I've just learned I had to rethink things, reinvent myself sometimes, and then I got work. And she said, when you're laid off, she said, it's really hard because you know you're not the only one out there because a lot of other people are going through the same experiences. And she said, I do empathize with the state workers, but she said, in the private sector, this has been going on for a long time. And so they're going to have to do just like everybody else did in the private sector, and that is figure out a way to get employed. And interestingly enough, Costco, the store of the Costco stores, are offering to do interviews with all of the employees. All they have to do is go in, and they may well have a job with Costco. But what brought that to my mind is I came across a statement made by someone trying to find creative ways to fund new concepts. And Americans are known for being innovative. This has just been a part of it. Let's see if we can make a better can opener or whatever. And that is absolutely what is necessary to be able to create new jobs. Now, there's a man by the name of Edmund Phelps. He's a Nobel Prize-winning economist at Columbia University, and also a Leo Tillman, who's president of the Strategic Advisory firm of L.M. Tillman and Company. They argued that the enormous pressure to produce an ever-growing profit, in their opinion, is choking off funds for innovation. So guess what they did? They've created a new bank. We're going to take a break for just a minute. When we come back, I'm going to tell you about this bank. I had never heard of it. So we'll take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment. Don't forget you can give me a call if you'd like to chat at 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008. Remember what I said before we went on break, that two people, along with some others, said we've got to do something to help the entrepreneur in the United States. They proposed a bank. Have you ever heard of the First National Bank of Innovation? I hadn't. Well, according to the information that I have in front of me, a government-sponsored network of banks, this is what it would be that would raise money around the globe to invest in new businesses here. They say the structure would be similar to the Farm Credit System, a nationwide network that serves farmers, rural homeowners, and other agricultural businesses. Entrepreneurs would be able to borrow at rates reflecting the riskiness of their ventures. And the attitude is, on the part of these two men, Phelps and Tillman, that business innovation ought to be declared a public policy objective, one at least as important as boosting homeownership and agriculture. I'll tell you, without agriculture, civilization collapses. That is important for any civilization. You have no food, people, they're not going to be productive. Fascinating stuff, but that's just a little tidbit that I wanted to share with you. Oh, and I've got a recipe for some chocolate chip cookies. Actually, no, let me share another one with you. This one was given to me by a girlfriend. They're called cowboy cookies, and I wanted to be sure that I shared it with you. So grab yourself a pad of paper and a pen, because this recipe is incredible. My friend Mary, she is one of these people. She's a baking-aholic. Yes, she absolutely loves to bake, and she has given me some of the best recipes. Now, this recipe came from a dude ranch, but before I share it with you, and I want to give you a chance to go get a pen and a piece of paper, because it's really amazing, and it's a huge recipe. Kids love it. Next week, we have got a whole lineup of people that are just terrific. We're going to be talking about the history of Thanksgiving with John and Sandra Thomas. They put together a publication that is absolutely awesome. And then we're going to be talking about mushrooms for healing and longevity. Ken Babel, I never knew so much could be around mushrooms. To me, a mushroom is just a mushroom. Not so. Then we're going to be talking turkey with Leo Pearlstein. He's a friend of mine, and he just had some of the best recipes that he shares. And then Practical Conscious Creation by Jackie Lappin is going to be discussed on Thursday of next week. And then you've been hearing ads about Topperson that I've been running. Well, I'll tell you, this stuff really works. And by the way, if you want to research, go to Topperson.com. If you want to order it, put in code DS for Donna Sebo, DS30, and by golly, you're going to get 30% off. This is an amazing product. And I've used it. I've had friends that have used it. It relieves pain. If you've pulled a muscle, if you've got symptoms of carpal tunnel, anything like this, it just is amazing. They're using it in hospitals around the country. Well, Lou's going to be on the air with me next Friday, and we're going to be talking about nutrition and a number of other things. So we've got a great lineup. I hope you'll tell your friends. And just tune on in, because you just don't know what you're going to miss if you don't. Okay, cowboy cookies. This recipe is incredible. It is not an easy recipe, but it is well worth doing. You're going to need two very large bowls to make the complete batch. So let me give you the recipe. There's no flour in this recipe. And when you fix the batch of the cookie dough, you need to chill it overnight before you bake it. So what Mary said she does, usually she fixes up the batch of dough, and then she puts it in the refrigerator and bakes the cookies the next day. Now, she said in her evaluation, this dough did not freeze well because the recipe calls for peanuts. Well, if you can't eat peanuts, I'd say use pecans or walnuts or almonds, whatever you like. But she said she adapted this recipe a little bit from this dude ranch in Arizona. And she said the cowboys, the reason they're called cowboy cookies, is that the cowboys on the dude ranch actually would pack them up to munch on to keep their energy up during the day. So you're going to need a good, sturdy mixer. This isn't something you're going to use with one of these little cutie hand mixers. It's not going to work. You're going to need a pound of butter at room temperature. You're going to need a dozen large eggs. You're going to need 2 pounds of brown sugar. You're going to need 1 tablespoon of corn syrup. You're going to need 3 pounds of creamy peanut butter, 3 cups of sugar, 8 teaspoons of baking soda, 2 teaspoons of vanilla. Now, you need to mix that. You've got to really mix it, and if you beat it up with a heavy-duty mixer, that's going to be the best. And then you take what you have fixed there, and you divide it into two very large bowls. And this is the additional batch of what you need. You're going to need 12 ounces of white baking morsels, 12 ounces of semi-sweet chocolate chips, 2 pounds of milk chocolate chips, and 6 cups of salted peanuts. She likes to add more. 18 cups of rolled oats, not your instant oats. It has to be the steel-cut oats. And she said, what you're going to do, you'd stir these ingredients by hand and then put half of that amount in each of its bowl. She said, you mix it all well, and then you want to pat out the dough on your cling wrap about 2 inches thick in a large rectangle. You should get 2 bricks per bowl. And you want to wrap it tightly, you want to chill it. And she said, you actually can keep it in the refrigerator for several days and then bake it as you want. And she said, when you're ready to bake, take your block, your cookie brick, I guess you'd call it, and let it set out at room temperature for about 10 minutes. And she likes to use a large ice cream scoop. And she places 6 to 8 scoops, depending on the size of the pan, on an ungreased baking sheet, or you can line it with parchment paper, and flatten each scoop with a flat-bottom bowl or glasses. You dip in sugar. And she said, reshape with your hands, placing any fallen bits back on top of the cookie. You need to bake them for about 13 to 15 minutes. Don't overbake. And then with your spatula, when you pull them out, pull the sides in and reshape so that the sides are thick, not thin, and let them cool a little bit and remove them from the baking sheet very carefully because they're going to be very hot, and you want to put it on wax paper and cool it, or on your racks and cool it before you try to move it. She said she always uses 3 pans because she has cool one to put fresh batter on. I'm telling you, these cookies are delicious. This is Donna Sebo. We are out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Have an awesome weekend. Hope to see you in class tomorrow. And we'll be back here on Monday, right here, bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.
Of all the places in the world, I wanna be in your arms. Of all the times to meet you, girl, you're right before you go. So why do you have to travel?